I'm Benny Herlin. I am no longer the international coordinator of Greenpeace's genetic engineering campaign, actually. I am now working for a foundation on future farming, it is called, which is a small German foundation that basically funds plant breeding privately for the public good, and I will try to talk a little bit about this. And also, this foundation has hired me to run a campaign to protect seeds from being, as we call it, contaminated with genetically modified organisms. And I'll tell you a little bit about that as well. Just a second. Let me start explaining why seeds have something to do, I believe, with the IT business. And that is because you can perceive seeds basically as information. It's replicable information, it's exchangeable information, it's transferable information, and it is, unlike computers, inheritable information. You could define seeds and the genetic information contained in seeds probably as an algorithmic music. Basically, you can then say life, including ourselves, is part of such an algorithmic symphony, which is composed basically of an unbelievable large but finite sum of DNA modules, of programming modules, if you wish. Of course, it's massively complex, and so it is beyond our understanding and ability to simulate, at this moment at least. But yes, in the end of the day, you can think of seeds as programs, if you wish. Now, seeds are probably one of the oldest information transfer projects of humanity. It started about 10,000 years ago and has been given from one generation to the next, long before we had symbols like writing. There was already this type of information from generation to generation. In traditional communities, it was the job of the women to keep the seed, and the seeds are one of the most important and most valuable information a community had and still has in many areas of the world. And you're probably familiar with these concepts of you never must eat up your seeds, because that will kill the community in the end. Today, seeds are stored in large seed banks and accessible for free in principle, or let me put it, in theory. One of the, I don't have the picture, so let's skip this. And seeds are still not completely under our existing patent system. They have their own intellectual property system called UPOV. It's a seed plant variety protection system. And the main difference between the UPOV system and the conventional patent system is that the inventor or the finder or the further developer of a new approved seed variety does have the exclusive right to market this variety, to sell it to farmers, or to sell the license to sell it to farmers. But he does not have the exclusive right over the information. That means everybody can take this seed, and then develop a new variety out of it without having to ask the owner of the plant protection right of the seed. So in a certain sense, UPOV can be perceived as an open source concept. It is not an open source concept like in the IT version, basically because we cannot describe most of the information properly that is in a seed still. So it is not the same level of information density, if you wish. Wait a second. I'll come closer to the presentation. And until about, I would say, well, 70 years ago or so, seed production was not a real business. It was mainly a public activity, public research activity, a public conservation activity, and a public information exchange activity. Today, seeds are a business, and this probably started in the United States as a big thing in the 20s, and it was with hybrid seeds, with the development or the invention of hybrid seeds, seeds which do not properly replicate. They are taken from two different strains. You create one seed, but the next, excellent. So, but the next generation does not have the same information as this one hybrid generation. The result of it is that farmers who buy these hybrid seeds have to buy new seeds every year. And this is where the business came in. As long as you can buy a seed once and then reproduce it on your own, obviously this is no big business. As soon as you have to buy these seeds year after year, this is big business. There are new methods now, apart from the hybrid system, to enforce this, and the main system, of course, is patenting. I'll come to that in a second. Still, at this moment, the seed business all over the world is probably only worth $30 billion, which is not a lot. And the seeds which are internationally traded is around $3.5 billion. Not a big business yet. And most seeds which are used are still not traded. It's estimated that probably when you look at the acreage, it is around two-thirds which are not traded, which are sown with non-traded seeds. And it is mainly the key big cash crops like maize, soybeans, wheat, which are big business, and vegetables. But still, for instance, the seed business in rice is absolutely marginal, even though rice is the most important food crop in the world. It is reproduced still by the farmers. Now, as this was not a big business, seed companies were actually pretty cheap, and over the past 20 years, 25 years, they have been bought up by a few big chemical, agrochemical companies, Monsanto, Syngenta, Bayer, DuPont, Dow, BASF. They are the key players. And they now control around 60%, together with another big company, Semillas, it's called, around 60% of the seed business, the international trade of seed, the seed business worldwide, which is, you ask yourself, why would they do it if there is no business? The reason why these companies believe it is business in the future is twofold. The one reason is that once you control the seeds, you also control the agricultural methods. For instance, when you look at the genetically modified organisms which are on the market today, most of them are resistant to a certain pesticide. And the pesticide is owned by the same company, right? So by introducing a certain seed, you also sell this pesticide. This is only the start of this business. There is much more around it. So if you can control the seeds which are used, you can also control the input used in agriculture, and this is big business. And the other reason is that in the future, these companies believe they will be able to fully patent everything around seeds. So the dream is that by being able to patent individual DNA sequences, by being able to patent obviously certain DNA transfer methods and other methods of creating these type of genetically modified seeds, you basically control the entire seed business as an intellectual property, no longer as the real property. And that means that farmers will have to pay for their seeds no matter whether they have bought them or not. The company says, look, your seed contains my patent, so you have to pay if you want to plant these seeds. That's the idea why seeds will be big business, probably. And also there are other technical methods like the famous Terminator technology, which are technologies that the idea is that the company can switch on or switch off the ability of the seed to reproduce. The seed will only be fertile if you apply a certain chemical compound of the company. And so that's the way you can then sell the seeds. It's probably a little bit like this idea of protecting computer programs with a certain code, and only if you have the code you can run the program. Over this same period, the public research in seed, which had been the conventional way of furthering and developing seed, has more or less ceased in the OECD countries. Here in Germany, there is no more public funding or considerable public funding for the development of new seeds. This is all being handed over to private investment. And the same, unfortunately, is also true in many developing countries. It is not true in China. It is not true in Brazil. It is becoming true at this moment in India, for instance, which is, I mean, these are where the people live and where the mouths are that need to be fed. And at the same time, also, the international funding for international research on seeds has been dwindling constantly. You're probably familiar with this concept of the Green Revolution, the high-yielding traits in the 60s. This still was all publicly funded research in seeds. Now, the Gene Revolution, as the companies call it, is basically an exclusively private enterprise. And the result of this is that the private companies will only invest where there are wealthy and big enough markets, obviously. So the idea is to look for agricultural Viagras, so to say, for blockbuster type of seeds, and that has a massive impact on agriculture. When you look at the decrease of agricultural variety of different seed varieties which are used with the main crops, this is astonishing. It has been reduced over the past 50 years by more than 75%. So only about a quarter of the variety we had 50 years ago is still used. It's a high pressure towards uniformity, and that also makes our food security dependent on number one, a few companies, and number two, good luck. If one of those highly used seed varieties gets susceptible to a certain disease, this is a massive problem. So food security is directly affected by this change of the seed business. And as you're probably aware, we are expecting substantial climate changes over the coming 5 decades or so. And this will have a massive impact both on the challenges to have new seed varieties to adapt to these climatic changes, but it also will imply new diseases appearing in areas where they are not expected today. This is the same for human diseases, but also for plant diseases. So we know that our food security will be much more vulnerable in the future, and we know that those who control this food security are just a few companies, and the public, especially the governments, have basically given up control over this sector. This is why we have started this small foundation. Now we're coming back to the very tiny little small seed type of solutions we are working on at this moment. It's a foundation called the Foundation on Future Farming. It exclusively funds the development of new seed varieties for organic purposes. The background is it's an organic-minded group of people who bring up this money every year, 1 million euro. It's not a lot, but it is at least substantial. And to give you an idea, to develop a new seed variety takes between 7 and 9 years. You cannot speed this up substantially. By the way, also not by genetic engineering, as promised many times. The GM varieties which are on the market have all been developed in the 80s, actually. The significance of this breeding program is that the breeders usually, for these type of breeders who don't take a lot of money and who also try to make a living from other sources as well than the breeding alone, developing a new variety costs between 150 and 250,000 euros over the 7 years of development. So if we put in a million every year, this is really a small business at this moment, but we hope that it will develop. We have now the first varieties approved here in Germany by the... If you develop a new variety, you need to go through a very complicated, cumbersome, and expensive approval process, which is run by the government, by a special agency of the government, the Bundessortenamt, the Variety Authority. And we have the first varieties now approved. Interesting enough, one of the varieties called Rodelia, it's a carrot, was the first variety, you probably don't believe that, it was the first variety which the German Variety Authority has approved because it has a different taste. All other varieties have been approved because they have better agronomic properties, because they are resistant to this or that, because they are growing faster and bigger and whatever. It has been the first one where we achieved that the authority accepted that a different taste, it tastes really wonderful, a different taste is also a quality that warrants to accept a variety as a new variety. So this is also part of the philosophy behind this group of breeders whom we are funding. We are not just looking at the typical straightforward agronomic tasks. We are also looking at better taste, at more fun and more joy, if you wish, which always had a lot to do with seeds. So that is one of the things we do. Of course, we try to also do some lobby work. We achieved that the German government, where the agricultural minister at this moment is a Green and a good friend of mine, has actually started to fund this type of organic breeding with roughly €1.5 million per year at this moment. So we're also trying to revitalize and also sharpen the awareness of the public authorities and also of a broader public for the need of starting to have public breeding and public research in the breeding sector again, and not leave this all to private companies. One of the reasons this has to be funded is that obviously the organic market, it's around 3 to 7% in European countries at the moment, will never be able to refund this type of research at this moment, right? So there is no chance to have any really profitable varieties for this small market. The other activity we're working on is this Save Our Seeds campaign, and that's paradoxically the other way around. We want to keep GMOs, genetically modified organisms, out of conventional and organic seeds. At this moment, you're probably aware here in Europe, it's a big debate whether or not to introduce GMOs at all. Legally, it is now possible to grow GMOs, and it will probably happen in the future. And then the companies say, unfortunately, a little bit of these GMOs will have to be in all seeds. That is nature at work, they say. Well, look, they are outcrossing. The information flow cannot be entirely controlled. And so they say up to 0.5% of the seeds, also of conventional and organic seeds, must be accepted to be probably genetically modified. I have a picture how that would look. This would be a GMO-free maize field with 0.5% GMO contamination. It's to scale. It means 200 to 500 GMOs per hectare, which is quite a lot, actually. Now, those symbolized GM varieties would be patent protected. We have major concerns about the environmental safety of GMOs. This is the first concern why we want to have at least clean seeds in the future as well. But also, when you look at the dynamics and when you look at a recent lawsuit that has been lost by a Canadian farmer, where the High Court of Canada said no matter how this farmer got patent-protected seeds, in this case oilseed rape seeds, from Monsanto on his field, he could prove he hadn't bought them, he has to pay a royalty to Monsanto, and Monsanto has the right to prevent him from using these seeds. Now imagine, once you have these seeds in your field, sooner or later Monsanto will come and say, hey, look, these are our seeds. You want to pay for that. That's the law. And when you are a plant breeder, this is even more important, right? This is in a field for a farmer. But if a plant breeder gets a contamination with a GM, with a patented GM seed, in his very initial small amount of seeds, and only finds out in the end that there is a patented gene in the newly developed variety, Monsanto will tell him, well, look, we're sorry, but this is our seeds. You have to pay a royalty or you cannot use and sell these seeds. And you can forget about this research. This is one of the things I think it happens in any area. It's the same in the IT, or it's definitely the same in the area of drug development, that patents work like mines, in a way. They prevent research in a certain area. You can no longer develop something without using a certain patent. So if this patent is owned by a certain company, you either work with or even for this company, or you don't do research in this area. And that is a problem that we will face in the areas of seeds as well. Now, this is at the very beginning. As I said, most of the seeds are still not even traded, in especially developing countries. And this concept of having to pay patent royalties for seeds has been only enforced so far in the United States of America, in Canada, and in very few other countries. Even here in Europe, at this moment, you don't pay patent royalties for seeds. You pay certain royalties under this UPOV system, but the patent doesn't work yet. But these patents will come up, I can tell you, within the next 10 years. That is about the time it will take until this type of seed business really takes over. And so I have a dream. I have a future campaign already in my mind. And that campaign is that you don't pay for any seeds that you have grown. So yes, you pay to the breeder to get some seeds, but if you reproduce these seeds, you don't pay for that anymore. That's the whole concept. And I think that very much leans to concepts of open source and GNU and so on and so forth. And so my dream is also that this will not just be a campaign of farmers, but it will be actually a joint campaign of open-minded and open-sourced IT people and farmers, and I think that will be an invincible campaign. Thank you.
I find it hard to believe that the resourcefulness that made anti-pollution legislation and anti-passive smoke invasion legislation can't be extended to anti-genetic modified pollution legislation along the lines of the Canadian example you gave. It seems like the companies know how to mobilize righteous indignation in behalf of the right to make money with their product, but consumers and others are not as good at mobilizing the complement to those strategies.
You're right. I think one of the reasons is that probably some of you even here might be astonished to hear that whatever you eat initially comes from seeds. At least this is very far away in the consumer's perception. Seeds are nothing you are concerned about usually. When you go to the supermarket and shop and buy your food, little resembles that this has to do something with seeds. And farmers, the small farmers, especially in developing countries, as I said, they are not immediately affected yet by this problem. While farmers in the United States, for instance, which are massively affected by this problem, Monsanto has Pinkerton detectives in the fields who go and look for where did they probably grow Roundup Ready soybeans, which they have not bought from us, and take them to court and threaten them. These farmers are not well organized, I have to say, in that respect. They simply have accepted this.
And they have an exact parallel case with pollution and smoke invasion, which it is, we didn't ask for this stuff to come over here. Get it out of here. Pay for getting it out of here. It's your expense, not our expense.
Right. What I said is, for the public, This whole problem is far away, right? The fields are far away from most urban people in the world, right? It's not like the smoke is coming your way everywhere. So it's a clear thing. You're affected by it, right? And that's the problem. And so it takes a little more thinking, a little more understanding, a little more translation. But on the other side, for instance, this campaign we are running to save our seeds, to keep the GMOs out of seeds, we were able to mobilize at least 200,000 people here in Europe, 300 organizations of all kinds. We have been able to prevent legislation that would allow this contamination since 2 years now, and the European Commission at this moment is struggling hard and will probably not succeed in passing this legislation. So there is some mobilization, I think. In the United States, it's a different thing. There is not too much concern about it at the moment.
Okay, I'll take one more question and then I have a final question myself.
Yeah, two quick comments. The first one was, can I take this off? Maybe not. That I too think that the intersection between media studies, you know, the commons debate and political ecology is one of the most exciting fringes right now of the commons debate. And I followed the seed business myself for some time, primarily from within the biodiversity debate, of which it is an important part. And major actors in that, of course, are also indigenous communities. And that brings me to my second question. It's, and I wonder what the Foundation for Future Farming thinks about that, because it seems to me that the solution is not necessarily going to be a commons solution. What's been happening there is that the drive towards proprietarization in agriculture has driven a lot of people to adopt what I would call a biocultural politics, a politics of biocultural property. So originary property claims made by indigenous communities and so forth, and this has been a parallel track to the commons debate. I don't know if you remember the Bellagio Declaration that was launched some 10 years ago by Boyle and Coombe and some of the people we would now consider the usual suspects, where they already said the claim for the protection of traditional knowledges and resources and so forth is really the one major exception we're willing to make in a general politics of the commons. And when you look at what's happening now by these communities, is they have in some sense jumped on this bandwagon, but they are, to stay with the metaphor, they are driving it in the opposite direction. Because there are historical associations, for instance, of the commons and Terra Nullius ideas, you know, and I think Hess and Ostrom have been criticizing misunderstandings of the commons for a long time that also underlie things like Hardin's strategy of the commons. So this is a relatively old debate, but what's happening right now is that these communities are not moving towards common solutions. They're moving towards DRM solutions. So there are many research projects that are trying to adapt digital rights management tools to the protection of traditional knowledges, including seed development. So it seems to me that there's a fault line here within the kind of happy community of activists that you envision that is there. I think there are a number of theorists that have made this point. But I'm not sure that a lot of these people that are affected are going to go towards accepting a common solution. I think we might very well see a different kind of proprietarization, but not really leaving the orbit of a politics of rights to talk about public domain and commons in this area of seed development.
You're right. I think the problem all started with the CBD, the Convention on Biological Diversity, which is an international convention which says that, number one, biological diversity should be preserved and who should pay for that, and number two, that the benefits of biological diversity should be shared in a fair way. As you know, most of the diversity is in the south, while most of the profit out of this diversity is being made in the north. That was the big issue of the CBD. So there is an agreement now that countries, actually, not necessarily communities directly, but countries do have a certain control over their biological diversity. And that companies who want to make money out of this diversity have to follow certain rules. They need the consent of the community and they need the consent of the country where they get the initial biological material from. And what happens there is that for, be it an indigenous community or be it a biodiverse rich country and government, this whole thing only makes sense if the big companies make patents out of this biodiversity and then pay a certain share, which is small enough anyway, to this so-called owner, or it's not an owner, but the protector of this diversity. So the CBD basically is an incentive for privatization of this type of biodiversity information, unfortunately. But I think this is one issue. It's deplorable, I think. It is very difficult also inside the NGO community. Many NGOs are focused on this question of biodiversity, and there is a lot of discussion, north-south discussion, about how to deal with this. And interesting enough, the companies, the industry, was the one at the CBD negotiations who said, hey, wait a minute, biodiversity is a global commons. Nobody should own it, right? And the developing countries, the G77 at these days, actually united against this type of global commons perception of the industry and felt that it was a victory to have some rewards going back to the biodiversity-rich countries. Now it proves that on the other side, this is, as you said, to a certain extent, an anti-commons approach. It implies a type of privatization. But I think this is about the patents on, say, genes for a certain drug and so on and so forth. When you look at the seed business in general, the situation is different. And as I said, this UPOV or seed protection system is not a classical patent system. Still, it is not, even though the patent system has invaded into it a little bit. And so I think we can make a distinction between that discussion and the question of how we deal with seeds and the right to use seeds and to reproduce seeds, no matter where they come from and what genetic information is originally coming from and who gets money from that.